You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 130 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Boulevard Park, Washington, the home of the Peltoncast.
Hello!
We got a fun pod this week.
Do we?
Well, actually, it's a fun pod for you.
Yeah.
It's not so fun for me. Because it turns out you had a pretty clear view of last weekend's football sporting events.
You've said this multiple weekends in a row now. This is maybe two out of the last three weekends you've said this.
Small sample size.
If you haven't done so before anything and you're still feeling a little bit chafed from last Saturday's Huskies game, you should go back and listen to the All Grievances pod that we did. Let me just say, it's only been 4 days. It holds up.
The weird thing is, like, I got over it pretty quickly, and especially after the Seahawks won on Sunday and the Sounders game, which we'll get to. Like, I was feeling okay about things, and like, I wasn't even sure whether I was going to post it on Monday, and then people talked about how much they liked it on Monday. Like, not a lot of people, the listener. Great.
This is still the podcast.
But you know, it's like, wow, that held up. I'm excited. That's good to know. So, yeah.
Well, we were able to get it out. But honestly, the winning two fantasy games plus the Sounders plus the Seahawks victory meant that I was able to get over it pretty quickly.
I only had the one fantasy victory because you also beat me head-to-head in fantasy football last week.
I remember that.
It really was a rough weekend for me versus vis-a-vis you. Although you being right about the UNM game was right in a really horrible way.
Well,
unlike the Seahawks game.
So we did that All Grievances pod. This is going to be an All You're Wrong pod.
Oh, no. It's not entirely going to be that. Because we'll talk about a subject that I was right about last season on many occasions. Or at least during the second half of the season. That being Husky basketball, we have a special guest this week. As you may have seen from the title of this podcast, we welcome Ken Pomeroy himself as third Pelton brother, a real meeting of the KPs. If you will.
But before then, should we get to this week's beer? As you're listening to this, it's Halloween.
Well, it's coming out. It's Halloween. It may or may not be Halloween when you're listening to it. It may already be back.
Anytime that you listen to it, it becomes Halloween.
Oh, okay, that works. So we, of course, had to go with one final pumpkin-themed beer for Halloween and picked up Elysian's The Great Pumpkin Imperial Pumpkin Ale, one of the beers, presumably, that Budweiser was lampooning in its anti-pumpkin beer Super Bowl ad right before they purchased
Elysian.
Did they
say we don't make a bunch of pumpkin beers?
I'm pretty sure pumpkin beers was specifically.
Pumpkin beers was in there. Ooh, maybe it was though, because I mean, this is the Elysian is the pumpkin beer company.
Lately, they've been going the Bud Light commercial is now autumnal mead, right? That's the joke.
But Bud Light is opposed to autumnal mead. I'm that guy. I know that I'm that guy in the ad. So whenever I see it, I'm like, okay, fine. But I can get on board. Here's the thing. I'm not that guy because. Whenever there's a crowd of people doing things and having a good time, I'm right there with them.
Oh, the 2015 ad teased, let them sip their pumpkin peach ale, which I think was a thing that Elysian actually did. They make many, many pumpkin beers, including the Great Pumpkin.
Named after a Charlie Brown special.
Correct.
The Imperial Pumpkin Ale, the Great Pumpkin, is the world's first Imperial Pumpkin Ale. It's packed with pumpkin and roasted pumpkin seeds and spiced with cinnamon, nutmeg, cloves, and allspice. So let's crack this open and let's talk Halloween for a second.
Okay.
That is very pumpkin-y.
You detect an aroma of pumpkin? Are we going to waft this before we drink it here? Should we toast to the Seahawks movie up to 6th in DVOA? Well, the toast to the sound.
I was actually toasting to myself.
That was not what I was toasting. I guarantee you that.
I was toasting to you being wrong.
Not what I was toasting. Okay.
This is actually one of the better pumpkin beers I've had.
Do we want to talk quickly? 538 released the latest version of their Halloween candy rankings as voted on, I think very similarly to the NBA rank voted, people picking head-to-head their favorite candy. Number one this year, the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup, followed by number two, Reese's Miniatures. A really Reese's heavy. Sixth, Reese's Pieces. Eighth, Reese's Stuffed with Pieces. Something that I had not had before earlier tonight when we went to the grocery store to purchase this beer. And I was like, for research, I have to get this. Mm-hmm. It was right there in front of me.
Absolutely.
Pretty good.
Pretty good?
Yeah.
So here's the thing. Because they get pretty specific with these rankings. Like, Reese's Stuffed with Pieces is not like a... Most of them are like normal signature candies,
well, right? There's 86 different candies that were on the list.
Do they have Reese's Peanut Butter Big Cup on here, though?
I don't believe so. Because it would have ranked in the top 10.
It would have ranked number one as a Reese's Peanut Butter Cup expert.
How long have you been able to eat Reese's Peanut Butter Cups?
Like 3 years. Oh, yeah. In that time, I have probably eaten more Reese's Peanut Butter Cups
than I have in my entire life.
Versus anybody's entire life. There were days at work where, and I have not had a Reese's Peanut Butter Cup in a while, but I would get just the bag of Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. This is not around Halloween. This is like middle of May or whatever.
Does it become Halloween when you get the Reese's bag?
I turn on this podcast. And I would eat the entire bag. Like, there are people who have seen me. I probably, in calendar year 2017, ate 700 Reese's Peanut Butter Cups.
700?
That might be exaggerated.
That's an average of over two per day.
Serious about how.
Okay, no, I'm sorry, not quite two per day, I should say.
I probably had 500. Okay, realistically, I probably had 500
Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. Still more than one per day.
Oh, I definitely was happy. When you have like 24 in a single day, that goes a long way.
That is a lot of days. That's true.
And basically, every single work day, I would get two. So that's 10 right there. Look, I've had a lot of Reese's Peanut Butter Cups is what I'm trying to say.
I don't know if I had 500 total pieces of candy in a given year as an adult. I'm pretty sure I don't.
I quit candy like 2 months ago or something. Months ago.
That's going to be fun for Halloween.
Well, I'm occasionally eating candy. I've kind of wavered on it.
That's actually not how quitting works. I don't know if you're aware of what that word means.
But I've scaled back severely.
Okay.
I quit and then I reached a moderate level of candy intake because I had 500 Reese's Peanut Butter Cups in calendar year 2017.
Yeah, that was very unhealthy.
It was excessive. So the best Reese's Peanut Butter Cup is the big cup because the thing that you want is more peanut butter.
The highest ratio of peanut butter to chocolate.
That's why Reese's Miniatures being at number two.
Yeah, that's complete. The ratio is off. I agree with you on that one.
Like those are to me Reese's Miniatures. If I had to rank them, and it depends on what we're including here. Number one is the Reese's Big Cup because there's a ton of peanut butter in there and a little bit of chocolate, or the same amount of chocolate that you'd get in a normal Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. Right. Number two would be the Big Cup with the pieces in it, just because for the same reason, right. Basically. Mm-hmm. The pieces add a nice little crunch.
That was a pleasant crunch.
But I still would never choose it over the normal big cup, the signature one. The other thing, though, is the seasonal Reese's Peanut Butter Cups.
I don't even know about these.
Well, for example, they'll make like pumpkins, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Like pumpkins and Easter eggs and things like that.
Bunny rabbits, right? Or they're Easter eggs. You're right. Yeah, yeah.
I think I would know.
I'm thinking of Peeps.
There are a lot of
are low on the list.
Halloween ones that they've had this year that I haven't had, and I'm not going to say I'm not dying on the inside, but they definitely have ghosts and pumpkins, and so those are pretty good too because width-wise you're getting a lot more peanut butter because mm-hmm. The little like crumpled edges on the normal peanut butter cup, they're just a waste.
All right, so also high on the list, we've got Twix, Kit Kat, and Snickers rounding out the top five. No argument there from me.
Ugh, Kit Kats are the worst candy bar.
Wow, that's actually what I have to give out on Halloween.
Do you?
Yeah.
Wow, I don't know if kids do this if they egg houses anymore. I might have to pay a trip over here.
I wanted to get something without peanut butter. It was trying to be cognizant of food allergies.
They're still made in a factory. If you wanted to get something, right. If you were worried about food allergies, you would get toys and put out a teal pumpkin.
I thought that would be difficult because of the fact that odds are literally no trick or treaters will come to my house.
So but
I
still you have just to be, wanted to eat Kit Kats.
So I have to get something that I am willing to eat.
Why
but I have
you
to
get
be prepared
Reese's peanut butter cups?
Because I food allergy reasons.
For who? For what?
I don't know.
Okay. Look, you're like going like 40% of the way.
Okay.
If you really cared about food allergy reasons, you would have gotten like a Sour Patch Kids or a Swedish Fish.
But I wouldn't eat
those. Or a Starburst.
I wouldn't eat any of those.
I don't. You're like willing to sacrifice your own personal taste. I'll tell you what's underrated on this list, though. It's clocking in at number 9.
Oh, peanut butter M&M's?
Peanut butter M&M's.
Undoubtedly.
The best M&M.
Yeah, I think there is a case to be made. We talked about doing a rankings, but it's been done, including by us last year.
And the year before that.
Well, not all of those years. Many of those years we were recording a podcast.
We did it personally to each other.
Okay. Peanut butter M&M's may have ascended to the top of my list.
Wow.
They may have surpassed Twix, I think, were my number one last year.
Twix are pretty good.
Twix just ahead of Snickers, which were for a long time my number one. But peanut butter M&M's are great.
The other thing in here where it's like number 12, Three Musketeers, that's literally only in there because of marketing. Like at some point...
See, that's how I feel about Milky Way, but I know there are people who like Milky Way.
Well, Milky Way is just a Three Musketeers, but slightly better.
Right. Oh, 100%.
And the other problem is that these are all being ranked together. And it's like... I mean, I guess like... The Cardinals are in the same league as the Rams, right?
They're playing the same sport, technically.
They're playing the same sport. But that's the difference between a Three Musketeers and a Reese's Peanut Butter Big Cup.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
One of them is undefeated. I'm going to go with the 49ers. The other one of them is starting CJ Beathard.
Oh, boy. Didn't the 49ers beat the Cardinals, though, on Sunday? That happened, right?
No, the Cardinals won that game.
They did?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. It shows you what close attention I was paying to
also looking the NFC. Sour Patch Kids at number 22 were severely underrated. Swedish Fish at number 33 are pretty underrated. Again, I still feel like
I felt Nerds at number 30 were underrated.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I'm a bit of a mound stan.
You should keep that information to yourself. Imagine talking to an actual human being. I mean,
like, I'm a bit of a mess. Candy corn is appropriately rated at number 67.
Too high. Still overrated.
Oh god, red vines. But some of these are just like they went to 88.
Chiclets, I don't think are actually.
We talked about this before. Like, Good and Plenty, appropriately rated as the worst candy in the entire world.
I still might put candy corn lower, but it's in the right ballpark. All right, so since we're not going to rank Halloween candy this year, instead, you have decided to step up with a ranking of your favorite all-time Simpsons Treehouse of Horror Halloween specials. You're still scanning the list?
I was reading an email. Okay. Like, I'm doing business over here. Booking podcasts. I'm doing everything.
Not our anyway, podcast.
Not the Pelton cast. Don't worry, people. Don't worry. I'm booking other podcasts.
Don't be alarmed.
So Treehouse of Horror, the Simpsons episodes that come out on or near or slightly after Halloween sometimes. There were times where
due to the Fox baseball schedule?
Yeah, good God. Like,
which, by the way, Game 7 of the World Series was supposed to be tomorrow, right?
Oh, well, RIP.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be on Halloween.
It was.
Wow, that is horrible scheduling.
Is it?
Yeah.
The game starts really late on the East Coast. I'm not sure if you're aware of that.
But people on the West Coast would be trick-or-treating when it was happening.
But then there will be the next 3 hours because it's a playoff baseball game.
And then it'll go to 1 a.m. So
even if you miss the first 9 innings, there's still the back 9 to go.
So they're a staple of the Halloween season. I'm not going to say, though, that watching the new ones for me is a staple because I probably haven't seen one in 5 years. As with most Simpsons episodes, I stopped watching them like 18 seasons ago. But I wanted to rank my favorite segments from the Treehouse of Horror series, and it really we're looking like the first 6 years.
Okay, so it's segments as opposed to the entire episode. I guess that makes sense.
They're all separate, and I wouldn't be like, there's no cohesive
It's like sketch comedy.
To them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You wouldn't rank your favorite Chappelle Show episode. You rank your favorite Chappelle Show sketch.
Yeah. And so, if you're not familiar, there's three little segments in each episode, Halloween-themed. It's not part of the what is the word that I'm looking for?
Canon?
Yeah, not part of the canon. Just like a one-off thing. It's fun.
Yeah.
Right? It's something that all TV shows should do. It's just having a fun one-off episode, all grievances. Anyway, coming in at number three, I only did my top three because we don't have time for five. Because the man wouldn't let him have 10.
That's good. That's a good joke.
Time and Punishment. So this is the episode where Homer Simpson, because of a toaster, gets sent back to dinosaur times. And he's reminded of the thing that Grandpa Simpson told him, which was, if you ever get sent back in time, don't touch anything. So basically, this is talking about, it's an episode about, what is the term, chaos theory?
Butterfly effect.
The butterfly effect. For here. So this is way before that movie Butterfly Effect came out. This is the first time that in whatever year, the early 1990s, that we're seeing something like this. Like, it's almost mind expanding. So Homer's trying not to touch anything before he gets sent back, accidentally kills a bug, comes back to the present, and there's the Ned Flanders dictator or whatever. And it's like a dystopian universe with Ned Flanders as the dictator. So then he goes back again, and it constantly is going back and forth. There's all these different universes that Homer is walking into. There's one where he has like a beautiful family or whatever. They're like wealthy and they have this amazing house. And he's like, can you pass me a donut? And Marge is like, donut? And then so he like gets out of there, and then it starts raining donuts. These are always my favorite episodes, where there's just a bunch of like quick things that happen with short, in an episode where there's three different segments, small things within that episode. So like Rick and Morty's interdimensional cable, or the second episode of season two of The Good Place, where it was just like showing all of the different restarts of The Good Place.
Spoiler alert.
Okay. Spoiler alert for the Simpsons episode also.
It's true.
It has to be said. Anyway, but also, this was like, I've thought about time travel so much since then, and I'm pretty sure this is the first time in the Simpsons episode that I'd ever even considered time travel.
Okay.
When you think about how young we were that we were watching this episode, I mean...
Do you know which year this was?
Latest it could have come out was like 1995.
Okay, number two.
At number two, The Devil and Homer Simpson, specifically for one section. So this is a thing where Homer Simpson... again, Ned Flanders offers to sell his soul for a donut. Again, donuts and Ned Flanders. And Ned
looks like, by the way, that was 1994.
So I was nine thinking about time travel. Although we probably didn't watch it until syndication in like 1998.
Quite possible.
Ned Flanders is the devil, offers him the donut. Eventually, there's a trial about who actually owns Homer Simpson's soul. And the best part of the episode...
He sells it for a donut, right?
Yeah.
Did you say that?
Yeah, I said that. Okay. His Ned Flanders as the devil chooses the jury of the damned, which includes Lizzie Borden, Benedict Arnold, Blackbeard, John Dillinger, John Wilkes Booth, Richard Nixon, who wasn't dead at the time, and the starting line of the 1976 Philadelphia Flyers. Which even then, like even now, I don't understand what that means, but I love that joke.
Yes.
Yeah. At number one. Attack of the 50-foot eyesores. So this is an episode where, again, really a lot of donut-themed episodes. Homer steals a giant donut from a lard lad character, who also is featured in like the type of character who is featured in like the Austin Powers movies. Mm-hmm. You know, steals the donut, and the character comes to life and is like terrorizing him, trying to get the donut back. And then all of the giant characters come to life. So like themed or advertising characters come to life and are terrorizing the town. And to get rid of them, Lisa goes to the advertising agency that makes the characters. And he's like, the one way to get rid of advertising is by not paying attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they come up with a catchy jingle sung by Paul Anka that just don't look, just don't look. It's got Paul Anka's guarantee. It's like, how do you not remember this?
I don't know. I have no recollection of that whatsoever.
It is imprisoned into my soul, this song. But also the theme of it. It's like, these are like joke episodes about Halloween. But you think about it, and it's like, they're actually kind of getting to like an interesting commentary on advertising.
Yes.
Where it's like, you don't pay attention to advertising, it's going to go away when it stops being effective. And it's like, the best of these episodes are the episodes that use this platform to make it, you know, like a statement about society.
Yes.
And have you think more about it. And I think from these three episodes, that is something that they did. Eventually, they just started doing movie parodies, and it became awful. So But at this period, they were doing very good stuff with these episodes.
Okay, so my I'm just going to give as a single bonus. My favorite Treehouse of Terror vignette we'll go with here is Citizen King.
Yeah, that would have been in my list if the man would have given us five.
Okay, where King and Konos both run for president. And then, this is along the lines of that. It's like a joke, but it's also a commentary. Like, they have to vote for one of them because it's a two-party system. And King is like, Min 2 is like, well, I believe I'll vote for a third party candidate. And King's like, go ahead, throw your vote away.
Yes.
So good.
Yeah. Where aliens take over the bodies of 1996, Bob Dole and Bill Clinton.
Yes.
And run for president as them and are very open, as far as we can tell, about being aliens. But still, people wouldn't vote for a third party.
Okay. Well, that was a good list. Happy Halloween to everyone. I guess we didn't toast to that. I don't know why we didn't toast to Halloween. That seemed like a more logical thing.
Toast to Halloween.
With that in the books.
We can toast to Halloween now.
Let's get to Seattle sports. And let's bring in Ken Pomeroy to talk about Husky basketball. Okay, we talked last week on the Pelton Cast about Ken Pom's preseason projections. And we figured no better person to help us break those down than to go directly to the source from The Athletic and his self-named KenPom.com. Welcome to the pod, Ken Pomeroy.
Thanks, guys. Last year was a dream come true to be featured in the Pelton mailbag, and now it's even another step up to be on the Pelton Cast.
I mean, this is like talking to royalty for us. I mean, we've been following KenPom.com since 2002.
I don't think it was quite ready in 2002, was it? A little after that.
I'm gonna call your bluff on that. There are about eight people following me in 2002.
I mean, it's pretty close. I mean, I'm gonna say thanks to the other KP here, to Kevin Pelton. We were probably one of the earliest adopters of KenPom.com.
Yeah, I mean, back when the only college basketball analytics that existed were you and some guy named the Big Ten Wonk, and I don't know whatever happened to that guy. who happened to be named John Gasway, and we all ended up working together at Basketball Prospectus.
That's a joke that very few people get.
It is.
But I remember distinctly going into the 2004 NCAA tournament, right? That was when the Huskies were a number one seed.
2005
NCAA tournament. The Huskies were a number one seed. Louisville that year was a number four seed, and I think we're in like the top six or something in the KenPom rankings. And it was like, we're definitely losing that game in the Sweet 16.
Yeah, that was a notably weak one seed. You know, that was when I first started doing this, kind of had to face the reality that teams were not seeded according to predictive rankings. You know, as they should not be. But Washington had kind of all the fingerprints that season of potentially being an early exit.
Right.
It was really kind of a poison chalice. I mean, it was a very exciting number one seed to get the number one seed, but then also to be matched up with Louisville was like a double edged sword.
Yeah, as I recall, it was like a late, like they just kind of snuck into that one seed line. Like nobody was talking about them all season. And then like the last weekend of the year, you know, there was some rumblings like, yeah, actually, you know, you look at their resume, like the Huskies deserve to be a one. And then they got it. So it was like they were very much under the radar.
And then was like 4 days of terror that the Huskies were going to become the first number one seed ever to lose to a number 16. So shouts out to UMBC for ensuring that if UW ever manages to get to a number one seed again, we don't have to worry about that. Okay, so the specific thing we're talking about last week, we'll get to the overall projections in a second, but conveniently, right after we had this conversation about UW's charity exhibition game win over Nevada, you tweeted out for your own podcast, the KenPom.com podcast, which I highly recommend, a call for questions. And so I went the other way and submitted a question for your mailbag about that, which you and your co-host Griffin Adams went on to discuss on the podcast. And it sounded like a topic that you maybe had already been thinking about, like what's kind of the meaning of these charity games. And then you wrote about on The Athletic this week. So what did you kind of determine when you looked into it?
Yeah, I mean, it was funny because I sent him a list of topics like a half hour before I sent out that tweet, and that was on the list. Like, hey, let's discuss this, because that, you know, the one thing that jumped out at me when you looked at the box score was everybody played a lot. Like the starters played a lot. You know, it wasn't like your typical exhibition against, you know, Texas Permian Basin or somebody like that, you know, where the entire rotation gets in or whatever. It wasn't one of these like foreign trips where the coach is trying to get everybody in. It was, you know, it looked like a real game. It had, you know, big time refs and everybody kind of playing their usual minutes. And so after the podcast, I looked at, you know, basically how well my model would have predicted last year's charity exhibitions, of which there were many more than this year due to a change in NCAA rules, but there were 33 last year. And basically the model would have done pretty well forecasting it. The average error would have been 9.7 points on the margin of victory. The average error on the first day of games is 9.0, or was 9.0 last year. And obviously those games are included in the rating. So a little bit of an advantage for the first day. So you can pretty much take it as, you know, almost how you would take a result on the first day. Like, you're not going to like read too much into it, but you know, you're going to consider it. You're not going to ignore it unless there's some sort of extenuating circumstances. And really, I think the only extenuating circumstances were on Washington's side for this game. So the fact that they were able to win so convincingly, I think, is, you know, something not to be ignored, and, you know, bodes well for the Huskies.
Do you think, just giving the biggest guesstimate that you possibly could, if you could answer our question, going into the season, Washington in your rankings ranked at number 46, Nevada at number 6, with a road victory against Nevada, say that it happened in the first game, you know, just off the top of your head, how many spots do you think Washington would rise with a victory like that?
Yeah, there's a pretty decent comparison. Last year, the first day of the season, Texas A&M beat West Virginia. The first day of the season, they beat them by 23 on a neutral site. West Virginia was 7th in my system at the time, and A&M was 15th, so they're, you know, a lot higher than Washington. But they got about a 2-point bump, A&M did, for winning that game. So roughly a similar result. You know, you take out home court, 23 points is, you know, in the ballpark of an 18-point road win. So Washington being ranked lower would get a little bit more of a bump, you know, maybe like 2.5, I'm guessing, 2.5 to 3, somewhere in there. So that puts them in the 32 to 35 range. So right now they're sitting at 46. So, you know, that would be the bump for that one game. It's hard to really like completely move the needle with one win, but you know, that'd be a pretty nice bump for Washington after that game.
All right, I can't remember who that means won our debate. I know I was a little
rest
low.
Rest assured that one of us won that debate.
I thought it would put the Huskies like maybe in the low 30s, like the just inside the top 40. So they are higher. That would be a bigger jump than I was thinking.
All right, well, congrats to whoever.
We'll have to review the tape to find out for sure. Tristan talked about the preseason rankings, preseason projections. Can you kind of explain to people how those projections are done?
Yeah. So it's, I guess the way I explain it now is like a kind of a hybrid team player model. So, you know, it has a bunch of like team information in there that's just independent of the roster, you know, basically how good the team has been the last 3 years. There's a factor in there regarding a team's spending on basketball over the last, you know, 3 years or so.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so just kind of a baseline for like how good the program is, roughly. And then it has some player information in there as well. So it looks at, you know, who's coming back, like basically what production is coming back, not just what minutes are coming back. So, so what kind of production is coming back? If, you know, players were hurt last year, you know, it factors that. It basically grabs everybody who has Division I experience somewhere. That goes into it. And then some limited recruiting information goes in there, basically like, you know, kind of impact recruits, roughly top 50 or so really can impact a team's rating. It actually has information for the top 100. But once you get, you know, down to 50 to 100, it's, you know, very small movements for recruits like that. So I think that's, you know, that's basically the nuts and bolts of it. You know, I think it maybe contrasted a little bit with like, you know, the typical NBA model, which I assume is kind of almost all player based information. Obviously, that's more of a challenge in the college game, although there are other models out there that just use player information more heavily. But it's really, I think, tricky, you know, doing that in the college level, just because there's such a wide variety of circumstances for all these players. You know, if they're staying on the same team, that's one thing. But when they're switching teams or, you know, trying to analyze a three-star recruit and how much impact that'll have on, you know, some lower level college, that's much more of a challenge. So yeah, that's basically the idea.
And you've also got a lot more players who you don't really have any statistical background to project them from, or maybe just garbage time if it's someone who's coming into a rotation, whereas, you know, everyone who's in the NBA plays at least a certain number of minutes, and then I can also use stats from other leagues. So, yeah, definitely many reasons that it's easier to project players at the NBA level than the college level. One thing that stands out looking at this year's projections is they seem to be much lower on the Pac-12 than kind of the general, you know, AP ranking preseason consensus, which has the Huskies ranked in the top 25. And I think three Pac-12 teams are in the AP top 25. And the KenPom projections, no teams in the top 25, with Oregon leading the conference at 27th. Anything specific that stands out as to the kind of the discrepancy there?
So my ratings tend to have like a lot of inertia in them, you know, just based on the fact that you have, you know, there's this team component of it that is going into the mix. So, you know, last year was not a good year for the Pac-12.
You're saying the no Pac-12 NCAA tournament wins, that was a bad year?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. That would be a bad year. And, you know, they didn't have any teams in the top, you know, 25, in my system at the end of the season, and just one other team besides Arizona in the top 50, and that was Arizona State at 49. So I think people underestimate a bit how rough it was for the Pac-12 last year. And I mean, basically they've been lagging behind the other Power Five conferences here consistently in recent years. So that actually it's worth mentioning, another ingredient in the formula is actually there is conference gravity, I guess you could call it. So kind of the conference's history goes into the mix as well. So, so given that there's, you know, not necessarily, you know, a high level like Pac-12 team from last season that brings a lot of guys back, it's really hard for a Pac-12 team to jump into the top 25. You know, I think probably the public maybe looks at like Washington's situation a little bit differently than obviously my model does, where they were, you know, hovering around the edge of the top 100 all last season. Whereas, you know, in the public's mind, they were a borderline tournament team most of the season. You know, they're obviously in the discussion. And so even though they bring a lot of guys back, it's really hard in my system to move from, you know, 98th where they finished up to the top 25. So that's another factor. And I actually think there's a third factor involved with the people who vote, is that I think they look at the Pac-12 and like, whoever wins the Pac-12 is probably going to be a top 25 team. Like fully admit that they'll probably be a top 25 team in my system. But I think people kind of work backwards from that. And they're like, well, I think, you know, whoever it is, Oregon or Washington or whoever, is the best team in the conference. So they have to be a top 25 team. So I'm going to, you know, rank them preseason top 25. And, you know, that's not exactly how it works. Like trying to peg any individual team right now to be a top 25 team, I think, is a little risky. Although we can say, like, whoever wins the conference, you know, will be a top 25 team. There's a little bit of a contradiction there that people have trouble negotiating.
It's a little bit like I hear about my projections that, you know, often there's no team that's projected to win 60 games, and people will point out, well, you know, most years, at least one team and maybe a couple win 60 games, but it's just that you don't necessarily know going into the season who that team is going to be. I think kind of similar.
Yeah, the same thing happens in my conference projections. Like, I mean, right now I have Oregon with the best conference record projection at 13-5. And I mean, obviously the team that wins the Pac-12 is going to be better than 13-5. You can just look at history, but trying to predict which team is going to do that is the challenge. I mean, it basically just tells you that, like, every year, like, whoever wins your conference has, you know, obviously been good, but they've also, you know, overachieved to some extent, or, you know, just surprised on some level. Like, players develop faster than you might have expected. So yeah, when you have, you know, realistic projections at the beginning of the season, they tend to bunch teams up towards 500 more than the final standings will look like.
So one thing you mentioned in there is, and this helps account for why the Huskies jumped from 98th in the end of last season's rankings to 46th in the preseason's rankings, the fact that they are bringing everyone back who played at least 11% of their minutes last season. In general, how important is that kind of continuity, and then also the experience that the Huskies are going to have for the first time in a while, in all likelihood starting at least three seniors and possibly four, depending what happens with Dominic Green or Sam Timmons in that kind of fifth spot in the lineup? How valuable are those things in terms of trying to project how good the Huskies and other teams are going to be?
Yeah, I mean, in the model, it's pretty valuable. You know, obviously there's a lot of overlap between continuity and experience. They're, you know, slightly different things, but you know, what I tend to look at past teams and project forward, like, continuity tends to be slightly more important than experience. So I don't know exactly, you know, what that means, but basically if you're bringing guys back, it doesn't necessarily matter, you know, whether they're seniors or juniors or sophomores. If they're coming back and they've been in the system, they played a lot of minutes, like, that's a good thing. As far as how that impacts the projections, you know, obviously returning production is a significant factor. What's kind of interesting about it is that, like, maximum continuity is not necessarily a great thing. Like, there's a sweet spot there. So there are cases where, like, if you have a player who is, let's say, below the team average in terms of ability, if that player leaves the team, it actually can help the ratings a little bit. Like, it depends how bad the player is. They have to be, you know, quite a bit worse than average, but it's not unusual. Like, a player will transfer and I'll rerun the ratings and the team, you know, will improve. And it makes some sense. Like, you know, if a guy's transferring out who isn't very good, like, chances are the guy, you know, he has a reason for transferring out. He's not going to get minutes that year or whatever. There's a replacement coming in that's probably a little bit better. And so the system is smart enough to catch that. So, you know, Washington doesn't have, like, any major offenders on that front, but it is interesting, like, just having 100% returning minutes. For some teams, that's the max, you know, kind of cutoff point. But for other teams, it's like, well, actually, you know, if you lose this guy or that guy, it'll actually help your rating a little bit. So so that's kind of another quirk, but I think a useful quirk of the system.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Do you feel like, I mean, for us hearing the Huskies move from 98th to 46, if the general perception of the team was they were the 70th best team last year and people were kind of moving them up a similar amount of rankings, where you end up with them being ranked in the top 25 to begin the season, it all kind of checks out. Do you feel like your rankings in the 16 years that you've been doing them have started to influence pollsters or the NCAA tournament selection committee at all?
So let's start with pollsters. Like, I'm a little bit sensitive to that. Like, I think, I don't know how many people vote in the AP poll, somewhere around 60, like 63, something like that. And I would guess, like, 5 probably really care about my rankings enough to be influenced by it. But I am sensitive to that. And for that reason, I do release my ratings pretty late, usually after the AP voters, at least, have submitted their ballots for the preseason poll. So I try to keep that as independent as possible. I still get, you know, the occasional voter asking me a question about where I have teams ranked or whatever. But for the most part, I feel like those are two independent things. When it comes to the selection committee, there's specific cases have influenced the selection committee. For the most part, again, they're not too concerned about my ratings. I mean, the rankings are now on their team sheet. So that, you know, last year, I believe, was the first year for that. So they do have, like, easier access to them than they did before, but I still think their overall method is relatively unchanged than it was, say, you know, 10, 15 years ago before they knew who I was. So for the most part, I don't think they're influenced by that. There has been the case, you know, the Wichita State case from, I guess it was like 3 years ago now, where they were, you know, a top 10 team in my system. And, you know, by traditional, like, tournament selection methods, they were a bubble team, and, you know, they ended up getting into the tournament. And I think there was, like, a clear, like, kind of bump given to them because they did rank well on predictive metrics. So in those specific cases, I think it matters. But, like, I don't think my ratings cost Washington a bid last year, if that's what you're trying to get at.
No.
Yeah,
they weren't something we wanted to advertise, but I don't think that. I mean, it was interesting. A few years ago, Drew Cannon, who now works for the Boston Celtics, came up when he was our colleague at Basketball Prospectus with the, quote, easy bubble solver, which was to just average the team's rankings in the KenPom rankings and then RPI. And that almost always nailed who was going to get at large bids. So that was interesting.
Yeah, and so I guess the question there is, like, I mean, I think he wrote that piece. I mean, how long ago was that, Kevin?
2012.
Like, okay, so I guess, you know, kind of in the beginning, I think, of where people were aware of what I was doing, even, like, college administrators who might not normally, you know, be open to this kind of information. But, you know, yeah, the question there is, like, how much of that is, like, direct influence from me and how much of that is just, like, direct influence from what I'm measuring, you know? I mean, I think the committee is on some level influenced by scoring margin and, you know, maybe more sophisticated ways to understand strength of schedule. Like, I don't know, maybe not the latter part, but certainly scoring margin they're to some extent influenced by. And so that, you know, may have played a role. In 2012, I'm especially skeptical that the committee was influenced by my work, just because I think it was that season. Like, I remember going to a game and actually sitting next to a committee member on press row and, you know, kind of shooting the breeze with them. And like, the guy like had no idea who I was. And so that's like one, you know, 1/10 of the committee. I mean, I'm sure he wasn't the only one on the committee who didn't know who I was. So, so I think that was probably a little early for, you know, any claim of influence on my part.
Mm-hmm. Well, they definitely helped us filling out brackets for many years, telling which situations the wrong team was favored. But I mean, for us, we're looking at it where you mentioned kind of the inherent biases that pollsters have, where they want whatever. That it's hard for a pollster to imagine that the first place team in the Pac-12 is worse than the 9th place team in the ACC, which by your preseason rankings would be the case.
And there was 1 year that wasn't hard for them to imagine, and you'll recall who won the Pac-12 that year.
That's rough. Won the Pac-12 the regular season. But we're honestly cheering for that, where it's like, I mean, you kind of have to do some adjusting based upon your rankings, and Washington being the second best Pac-12 team, it's like, well, that could translate to a 6th seed or being ranked in the 20 range throughout the season.
Right. I mean, whoever is the second place team is, you know, probably going to be a fringy top 25 team. I mean, I'm actually not as high on the Pac-12 as probably the general public, but yeah, I mean, it's hard to believe like, you know, Miami, for instance, is going to have a better year than Washington, I guess. You know, certainly, like, if you look at the voters, like, there are 63 voters and probably like 61 of them would have Washington ranked ahead of Miami. I mean, I think that's a little bit crazy, but that's what would happen. So in that sense, like, I feel pretty safe saying like the second best team in the Pac-12 is going to be better than the 9th best team in the ACC. It's just like, what are the specifics of that? Which teams are you going to slot there? And, you know, that's like, you know, we've talked about that before. That's like, that's the challenge, is like specifically who are those teams and trying to make bets on those teams or whatever you're doing to state your basketball knowledge or back it up is, I think, difficult in terms of just saying, hey, yeah, Washington is definitely going to be better than Miami. Like, what are the chances of that? It's, you know, I think it's a lot closer to 50-50 than people would guess.
So a topic we've discussed a lot on the podcast, so much so that it has its own spot on the Peltoncast bingo card, is the randomness of three-point shooting, and particularly opponent three-point shooting, which was one reason the Huskies were as successful as they were last year, holding opponents to 31% on threes in conference play, far better than the next best team, Arizona State, at 33.5%. Probably no person has done more research into the volatility of opponent three-point percentage within seasons and then from season to season as you have. I'm curious, though, your thoughts on, you know, whether Washington in particular could be an outlier like we've seen with Syracuse, who you noted at one point had had most exceeded the standard deviation of what you'd expect in terms of opponent three-point shooting in 2008 through 2012, playing their 2-3 zone that Mike Hopkins has brought to Seattle. Do you think that it's reasonable to expect the Huskies to continue to be above average in terms of three-point defense? Or opponent three-point percentage, since that shouldn't be how three-point defense is measured.
Nice catch. yeah. So I, you know, that's the thing. So I, you know, obviously started from a point where I first did the research of like, yeah, this is like totally random. And, you know, then you find cases that are somewhat predictable and clearly not random. And obviously the Syracuse defense is one of those cases. I think, you know, when you look, try to do like a regression and try to predict three-point percentage, opponent's three-point percentage, you know, you basically find that like the biggest effect is consistently, you know, you consistently demonstrate it's probably like 3% or so below average, or if you're a really bad defense, above average. That seems to be the biggest, you know, the most effect you can have. And just looking at like Washington and what they did in conference, like they were, you know, roughly like 5%. Below the conference average. So, you know, they had, they probably had, you know, some luck involved there. Like maybe there's some, you know, we don't know what the exact skill is. Their non-conference three-point shooting defense wasn't quite as good. And that's a little bit like unusual, I think. Like the one thing about Syracuse is I feel like that 3% value is not a constant. Like if Syracuse played, you know, the best, like, high school in the state of Washington or whatever in terms of shooting, like, you know, that team would do a lot worse than 3% on, you know, deviation on the 3-point shooting. And so they, you know, they beat up these teams in non-conference. And after 5 or 6 games, we'll probably look at the leaders, and Syracuse will, you know, be among the leaders in terms of 3-point percentage defense. And it'll be a figure much better than 3% below national average. And then when they get into conference play, like, the numbers get more variable. And you can see that over time. Like, they're usually average to above average in ACC play. Not always, but usually. But as teams get better at kind of beating the zone, they you know, tend to be a little bit more immune to, you know, the length on the perimeter. Like when you look at, so I guess to me, the bigger question is, like, what's the source of this? And I don't know if you probably have your own opinion, which I'd be interested to hear. To me, like, when you watch Syracuse and you look at their numbers, like, they give up a lot of threes. Teams don't get easy twos against them. Defensive possessions are really long, so teams are probably taking really difficult threes, and especially late in the shot clock. And so there's a factor there where Syracuse's length, you know, contesting shots causes problems, but there's also a factor where teams are just taking predictable, difficult shots late in the shot clock. They're easier to defend, and that also contributes to the good 3-point numbers for Syracuse.
Yeah, I mean, if you're trying to explain why teams are above or below average in terms of opponent 3-point percentage, the best way to do that is to look at their opponent 2-point percentage. And Syracuse has generally been, you know, they've had some average years, but they've generally been pretty good at that over the course of Jim Boeheim's tenure, which, you know, makes sense given the way that the zone is designed. That's what was interesting at UW last year, is even in conference play, they were only average in terms of 2-point percentage defense, but still had this great 3-point percentage defense. So it's going to be interesting to see how that evolves, I think, this year.
Yeah, and that is a concern. You know, the other team running the Syracuse defense is Eastern Michigan, which obviously is on quite the same level, but, you know, they haven't had the same success in terms of 3-point percentage. You know, one thing that I did come across this summer was fact that I think Washington blocked the most 3-point shots.
Well, that's all Matisse Thybulle.
Right. So Matisse Thybulle led the country individually. I think he had 17. And as a team, I think Washington had 29. I know Thybulle had 17. I'm not sure about the team total, but I think it was around 29. And so I looked at, like, hey, you know, let's look at the correlation between 3-point block percentage and unblocked 3-point percentage. I thought I was onto something. I thought I had kind of a proxy for challenging shots. And as you alluded to, there's actually a better correlation between 2-point block percentage and 3-point percentage, which was, and it still wasn't a great correlation, but it was significantly stronger than the 3-point block percentage, probably partly because there just aren't that many 3-point blocks to begin with, and the data is very noisy. But I was a little disappointed that I didn't, stumble across some sort of marker for good 3-point defense.
I was hoping Matisse Thybulle would be the secret sauce.
Yeah, well, that zone is the secret sauce for Matisse Thybulle, because, you know, yeah. I think, you know, the year before that, he blocked like 3 3-pointers or something like that. So obviously the defense suits him pretty well.
Yeah, he fell just short of, we were tracking this all season last year, whether he was going to be the first player in major conference, at least in the, like, advanced stats era, to get 5% block rate and 5% steal rate. He ended up falling just short with 4.8% block rate, which, what's even the point at that point?
He's having no impact on the game, yep. Clearly.
All right, well, Ken, thanks so much for taking the time to help us better understand your ratings. And, of course, we'll be following them as we track the Huskies all season long.
Thanks for having me on, guys. Another bucket list item checked off, so I appreciate that. And good luck to your Huskies.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks again to Ken for coming on. I did not realize that I would ever be on a podcast with so many Husky haters.
I did think about asking that, like, does he get the hater? Except in his case, obviously he gets it from fans, but I wonder if he also gets it from coaches.
From coaches that he's hating on their team?
I think Tim Miles, actually.
That's podcast that he's going on?
I think Tim Miles, it's like an ongoing joke with him.
Who's Tim Miles?
The Nebraska coach.
Oh.
Yeah.
Does Ken live in Nebraska?
No.
Oh, okay.
But he just, like, they tend to be ranked low in KenPom, and he likes to joke about it. So the Huskies will begin their season, well, not counting the Nevada game, which I guess they was the beginning of the season, but they play their second exhibition, this one at home, against SPU. And this is one of those exhibition games against lesser competition that Ken was saying is not very predictive, unlike the Nevada game. So, but we will probably get a chance to see the freshmen for the first time. They only played at the end of that game, didn't really get involved at all. And so that'll be interesting to see. Okay, so in a game that was slightly more meaningful, the Seattle Sounders...
Oh.
Completed.
We're not even sighing.
You were. Yeah,
I thought we were talking about the Huskies.
No, we'll get to them in a minute.
Oh, this is good news.
Completed the extremely long MLS regular season, which began way back in February, so many different like seasons in terms of weather ago, and facing on decision day the San Jose Earthquakes with a chance to finish as high as second in the Western Conference or as low as fifth with a loss. And in the early going, the news wasn't good for the Sounders. They were scoreless for the first 79 minutes of this match playing against the Earthquakes, who, as we noted last week, had allowed the league's tied for the third most goals allowed in MLS. And then the Sounders went behind on a Danny Hosen deflected shot against the run of play in the 63rd minute. And all of a sudden, it looked like hope of moving up was lost. And suddenly, the most important thing was that Vancouver was beating Portland 2-0 in their match at the same time, which would have assured that the Sounders would have finished fourth and hosted Portland in a first-round matchup at that point. Then some interesting news came in. The Sounders managed to equalize on a Raul Ruiz Diaz kind of body shot from a Christian Roldan corner. It wasn't a header. He chested it into goal. But it appeared they were going to settle for that draw as they headed into stoppage time, tied 1-1. And the interesting news was that FC Dallas, which had taken a 1-0 lead early against Colorado, had gone behind 2-1. And so if FC Dallas lost or drew, the Sounders had the opportunity to move up to second with a win. And so I'm sitting in there, and at this point, it's pouring rain after being pretty nice in the morning. Like, the weather had matched my mood. And I'm just thinking, like, it's more depressing that FC Dallas is going to lose because it means the Sounders had this amazing opportunity to move up into second and get a bye in the first round of the MLS Cup playoffs.
It's like the kick at the end of the Seahawks season didn't matter.
Right.
Like, missing that field goal is just like, whatever, who cares? We moved up a couple spots in the draft.
If the Falcons had lost,
yes,
it would have felt horrible that Blair Walsh had missed that kick, and that was the reason the Sounders hadn't made the playoffs, or the Seahawks hadn't made the playoffs. But lo and behold, the Sounders, in maybe a metaphor for their season as a whole, it started poorly, and then it got good at the end. In this case, right at the very end, is Ruiz Diaz scores on a counter in the 93rd minute to give them an improbable 2-1 win. And it was cool. I went to this game. It was the first Sounders match I've been to all season.
Wow.
And I was sitting in the south end zone of CenturyLink Field, which was the goal at which the Sounders were shooting in the second half when they scored both of these goals. And Ruiz Diaz comes over and everyone mobs him to celebrate, and he takes off his jersey in celebration right in front of me. It was like the perfect place to watch that all unfold.
You're gloating about how good of seats you had?
I mean...
Were you in a box on the field?
No.
Oh, okay.
Those are on the other end of the stadium. I mean, okay. I was like two sections over from the supporters group.
Oh, okay.
In that end.
I was imagining it the other end. So.
Yeah, I mean, they were good seats. They weren't that good.
Because I don't know north from south.
You do not. That's hashtag Peltoncast geography. And so that was basically the final kick of the game. San Jose did manage to get in a cross that Stephen Fry saved. And then attention turned to the video screens where they were playing the final minutes of that Colorado FC Dallas match, and Colorado saw out the 2-1 win, and lo and behold, that along with the result between Sporting Kansas City and LAFC meant the Sounders would finish second and get a bye in the first round of the playoffs. So let's talk about how unpredictable and amazing this was. Let's go back to June 30th when the Sounders sat 3-9-3 in MLS play. They had a total of 12 points from their 15 matches at that point. And I made a bad prediction about the season. Here's the thing. Can I give you a take?
Yes.
It's only the 4th of July. There are still approximately 8 months left in the MLS season. The season is over for the Sounders.
Wow!
I know that...
Calling it?
I'm calling it. I know that technically they still have 17% playoff odds according to the 538 Soccer Power Index projections. That's shockingly good given how bad they have been. That's a higher percent than they have points so far this season in the matches they've played.
But they're averaging something like 0.8 points per match.
It's a very low number. But look, the season is over.
Oh my God. Oh, I love hearing it.
I mean, granted, who could have seen that the Sounders were going to go 15-2-2 the rest of the way? I can't remember how much of that clip I caught. I included. But I also went on to say that like it was a good thing that the Sounders were out of it because they could integrate Rui Diaz and not have to worry about the fact that MLS newcomers always play terrible when they come in mid-season that first year. No, Rui Diaz only had 10 goals in 13 starts.
15-2-2. I mean, even to be playing well, you have to be both very good and lucky.
They have been very lucky, for the record.
But you have to be both those things, though. You can't just be lucky and get to 15-2-2.
You cannot just be lucky, no.
I mean, that is
This is the team we expected from the Sounders all.
If this was the team we were expecting all along, they'd be the best team in MLS history.
The overall level of play is what we expected from the Sounders. Obviously not this stretch, yes.
And it's amazing how the Sounders have been able to do it again.
Yeah.
Year after year after year. 3 years in a row having a turnaround like this where they were written off, where the playoffs were out of sight. This was the year where we finally said it was going to happen.
Yes.
And then they did it again.
This was the most hopeless of the situations and the biggest second half turnaround.
In their position right now going into the playoffs, I mean, there's no other team you want to play.
I mean, so we've talked about this before. Once you get out of the opening round, which is just one match, home field doesn't really matter that much, and seeding doesn't even matter that much. The Sounders, so they don't know who they'll play because it won't be determined until after the LAFC Real Salt Lake match on Thursday. We're also, as we record this, the FC Dallas Portland match is on Wednesday, so that's after this is going to come out. So don't know the outcomes of either of those. The Sounders can host either LAFC or FC Dallas or Portland. Real Salt Lake, not a possibility, because if they win, they will play Sporting Kansas City, the number one seed in the West. This is a good position for them to be in, because now after you get into the semifinals, which the conference semifinals, which they've automatically advanced to, those are home and home two-leg matchups. So home field doesn't really matter that much.
Incredible.
Which is partially why 538 doesn't actually give them that good of a chance of getting this, using the Soccer Power Index, doesn't give them that good a chance of getting into the Western Conference Finals, only 52%.
The company that statistically ranked Twix as the number four candy doesn't think that? Come on!
It's a slightly different methodology. But yeah, I mean, the way the Sounders are playing, I feel like they have to feel really good about their chances. So the first leg...
I choose to see those two things as equal.
Okay. The first leg of this matchup, we learned, will be next Sunday on the road, and then the Sounders will host the second leg on Thursday with a chance to advance to the Western Conference Finals. A week from
this
Thursday.
This is before the two-week playoff break.
The two-week playoff break, yes, it's before that, yes.
So the first match will be on Sunday,
Sunday, November 4th.
Okay.
So it's a quick turnaround if you play in that opening round game. You only get 3 or 4 days rest.
And then Thursday, November 8th.
That's one reason it's so important to get the bye. Yes.
Interesting.
So very exciting. We'll know more. The Sounders will have already played their opening game by the time we record our next podcast, but we'll also by that point, of course, know who they will be playing and much more about their chances, but feel good about things in a surprising way. All right, now, not feeling good about things. It's Husky football coming off last weekend's loss at Cal. Do you have any new thoughts? Are there any new takeaways with a few days' perspective?
Just go back and listen.
Okay.
Those thoughts were, I don't want to say they were in the heat of the moment because we waited a couple hours before we actually recorded it.
I mean, if we had recorded in the heat of the moment, I don't think it would have been suitable for air. You kept repeatedly.
We would have to put a parental advisory sticker on there.
Kept repeatedly cursing in front of your small children.
That's nothing new.
It's true. I enjoyed the tweet from our third Pelton brother, DJ Infrared, who said that the All Grievances edition of the Pelton cast is the Oops All Berries of podcasts. That was well done. So,
and also, shouts to Tiny Totem Michael Sawyer.
Yes. His tweet, fellow Totem at Tristan Caracino, reps well the Leave Brownie Alone hive and airs some damn grievances, all caps. Also at Cape Elton Talks, too. I'm choosing to interpret this as a direct Matt Radio shot. That's what I'm assuming that is.
There is also a Matt Radio Ram on the podcast.
All right, so my first big picture Husky topic going into this week is that the Huskies are much better than their record and where they are ranked, which is unranked now in the AP poll, as well as the first edition of the college football playoff rankings. Number 19 by the coaches, which is a weirdly large discrepancy.
The coaches know what's up.
Coaches do know what's up, but they still have
the Huskies. For the first time, the coaches know what's up.
Still have the Huskies too low. If you look at the statistical assessments of them, they are still ninth in the football power index. This is more or less the same thing. It's not on 538. It lives on ESPN.com, but more or less the same thing. And even if you go by the FPI efficiency that doesn't take into account where you start the season, preseason expectations, they are 14th if you just look at 2018 performance.
They can't factor in stupid coaching decisions.
I mean, I think that those are kind of factored in by definition.
Well, and also Vegas knows what's up. I mean, that's the thing. If you were to neutral site, take into account, granted, Stanford lost to Wazoo last week. Wazoo's clearly a better team. You know, Wazoo went into Stanford and beat them in a game that I didn't think they were going to win.
Yeah, no, great credit to Wazoo for that one.
But if you had Vegas rank every team on, like, how they would face each other team on a neutral site, I mean, the Huskies are probably around 15 in the country.
I would think so, yeah.
I think they would come much closer to where FPI ranks them than where the pollsters rank them, because it's all reactionary when it comes to the pollsters. It's not about actually how good a team is.
Actually, this is a thing that exists. And
is it a thing that exists?
It is a thing that exists. It's on unpredictable.com, and the Huskies are ninth. They didn't drop from last week at all, according to this. So there you go.
Wow, that's kind of amazing.
Utah is up to 11th, by the way.
Utah's legitimately a good team.
Like, which, by the way,
actually a signature win for the Huskies.
Yeah. You know who beat them? Who ended them? Is that their only loss so far? No, I think they have one other loss.
The thing is, I say that I've lost faith in Coach Pete, which isn't entirely true. I'm more reserved. I'm heightened.
I lost faith compared to where you started, which was all the faith.
Most of the faith.
Okay, I had all the faith.
But right now, I'm an elevated level of nervousness about Chris Peterson.
Uh-huh.
Do I still want him to be the coach for the foreseeable future? Of course.
All right, Utah lost to Wazoo.
Wow. Wazoo's the best team.
Well, that was in Pullman. So.
At the same time, do I still think that the Huskies are going to win out? I absolutely do.
I don't know if I think that's going to happen, but I certainly think it's a...
The only game that's in question is in Pullman.
Only game that's in question? You're saying no question they beat Stanford?
I just don't see it.
I mean, wow, okay. Well, I feel much better now, given the way that you've been seeing things lately. I mean, Vegas is confident. This game opened at a 7.5 point, favoring the Huskies by 7.5 points, and now is all the way up to Huskies minus 10.
But it's not even just Vegas. It's that people are betting on the Huskies, too.
Well, yeah, that's how they set the line, is based on how they're going to bet.
But I'm saying the movement is happening based upon not just the way that pollsters are setting it, but between the, I guess you would probably consider them like the sharps, you know, people who are getting that money in early and honestly betting on college football.
Yes. I mean, that's actually probably a little more optimistic at this point than the stats would say. FPI gives the Huskies a 73% chance of winning this game.
I mean, I don't want to go directly in a percentage chance of victory, but looking at, or do you want to do more topics here first?
Yeah, the other topic we have is the health for the Huskies. We had a report from Adam Jude of the Seattle Times that starting cornerback Jordan Miller will be back this week after missing last week, and he missed most of the Colorado game. We also got news last week of the possible return of Trey Adams and Hunter Bryant from their long-term injuries that have kept him out all season. It's looking good for Bryant, who traveled with the team to Cal, did not suit up for that game, but getting very close, and I think... My expectation is we'll see him on Saturday. As for Adams, he began practicing last week after his back surgery in September, but Coach Pete said at Monday's press conference that he's a ways away.
Could he be back in 2 weeks, though?
Possibly.
3 weeks, I suppose.
Yeah, 3 weeks is when... I mean, you'd like to get him out there, I guess, against Oregon State ahead of that Wazoo game. So take advantage of that well-timed Week 11 bye.
And any news on Miles Gaskin?
Looking good for Miles Gaskin this week, I think.
I really, honestly, I think the Huskies needed Miles Gaskin in that game. I think if he plays, that the Huskies beat Cal. There's just something about having him when things aren't going well, being able to have a series where they just load up on giving carries to Gaskin, and his just level of shiftiness that could have gotten them through some tough series.
I mean, he's still his third of the UW's four running backs in yards per carry, and not that much ahead of Sean McGrew.
Yeah, but Sean McGrew was the featured back.
And played better than that at Cal. It was really the inability, like the trick plays type stuff with Savon Ahmed did not work against the Cal defense.
Spreading it out didn't work.
Not necessarily spreading it out, but like, you know, the fly sweep type stuff.
Well,
with
there are plays where Savon Ahmed's losing like 8 yards on those carries.
But I don't think that has anything to do with him individually. That's just the play didn't work. The deception didn't work. It was nothing to do with Ahmed, and you wouldn't run those type of plays with Gaskin.
Well, and they honestly, coaching wise, this is the place that I'm most disappointed. Has there been a trick play all season that you can remember?
They might have run a flea flicker at some point.
I think there might have been a flea flicker, which is like that's like low level trick play.
Again, if you're looking for a quote a spark.
Should be catching passes.
Okay, that's a take. But maybe better. Maybe a better option.
You should catch a pass.
Trick plays may be a better option than throwing your backup quarterback redshirt freshman with 7 career pass attempts to his name on the road against an elite defense. But we went into that in the emergency pod.
I'm still not over it. But if we're going to start rationalizing, because you know we're going to start rationalizing.
I started rationalizing by the end of that podcast.
The path is clear to a Pac-12 championship and to a rematch with Utah, which is somehow a pretty... It could be a matchup of... If it's Wazoo, it's 2 top 10 teams, baby.
Yeah.
If it's UW versus Utah, it could be the number 15 team in the country versus a top 10 team. Like, it could be quite a showdown in the Pac-12 championship all of a sudden if Utah can close out their schedule.
Let's not look that far ahead. I mean, it's just good to know that that possibility exists. That's the important thing.
The door isn't closed. We know that the Huskies are. Where does Wazoo rank by FBI?
I think around 17th. Stanford's 24th. So there's still several. The Pac-12 North no longer nearly as many ranked teams as last week when I tweeted that they had the most. No, Washington State is 22nd.
The only window that is closed for the Huskies is the same window that was closed for them last week. And that's the good thing about
getting,
the situation.
Getting to the college football playoff without winning the Pac-12.
Yes.
I guess that was close.
They were not going to the college football playoff no matter what after that loss to Oregon.
Without winning the conference.
No, that's it.
Oh, the actual top 4 playoff. But I mean like a Big 6 game.
Oh.
I don't think they were getting to that without beating Wazoo.
Okay, so that actually may be.
Which then would put them in.
An at-large bid to a New Year's 6 bowl or whatever, yes. Power 6 bowl or whatever they call them.
Obviously gone.
Gone.
Yep. All right.
But they still can go to the Rose Bowl and still can win the Pac-12. And probably.
The only bowl game that I recognize.
Oh, God. And probably by FPI will be favored in every single one of those games.
Yes. Yes, they will. If they keep winning them, they will. Okay, so
Tell us about Stanford.
On the topic of running backs not playing as well as last season, it's been really tough to watch Bryce Love this year. Last year's Heisman runner-up came into this season averaging 7.8 yards per carry in his career, but after passing on the NFL, much like Myles Gaskin, and dealing with ankle injuries all season, has averaged just 4.5 yards per carry as a senior and has been limited to 92 total carries, including 5 last week, though those ones went for 68 yards, including one long one that he broke off against Wazoo. And so as a result, Stanford Cardinal, Jim Harbaugh is rolling over in the grave, in his grave as he hears this, which is also a good Treehouse of Terror sketch. Treehouse, what'd I call it?
Terror.
Okay.
It's the post 9/11 version.
Stanford is last in the Pac-12 with 3.3 yards per carry.
Unbelievable.
Last in the Pac-12. How? Like they have they're
telegraphing all these linemen. I mean, I'm telling you, we know how offense works now. They managed to run offense in a way that offense didn't work for a long time, but time caught up with Stanford.
Yeah, you've been complaining about this for a long period.
I seriously. I don't hate Stanford more than I hate Oregon, but I think we argued about this in our first ever Pelton cast.
You think so?
I'm pretty sure we did. Stanford and Oregon were playing a big game.
Oh, that is right. Okay. Yeah,
I wonder who their quarterbacks were then. Was that Mariota? Luck against Mariota?
Might have been. Their backups, Trevor Spates and Cameron Scarlett, are both averaging under 4 yards per carry. They've been much less effective than UW's Nolan Gaskin running backs. But here's the thing. Stanford's really good at passing. I mean, maybe it's the Seahawks style, where because of the fact that they don't pass that often and the play action is impressive. But KJ Costello is second in the Pac-12 in QBR behind Gardner Minshew, and his 8.5 yards per attempt are second in the conference behind, steal yourself, don't listen to this, Chris Peterson, you won't want to believe it, Jake Browning still leads the Pac-12.
I can't even joke about how Jake Haener would have completed every pass he would have thrown now.
Yeah, you can't.
It's too soon.
I thought it was an interesting quote from Jimmy Lake to the media earlier this week, who pointed out in terms of the lack of turnovers the defense is forcing, we're not getting a lot of footballs downfield. If you're really watching our games closely, it's all dink and dunk, Lake said, which is something we talked about last week.
They're the freaking Seahawks.
This week, these guys do push the ball down the field, and we are expecting them to challenge our guys. We've got to go up and make plays on the football, and you know who's going to do that, who they're going to do that with. J.J. Arcega-Whiteside, who was a big problem for the Huskies last year when they played without both starting cornerbacks. An aerial threat at 6'3", he was averaging 15.8 yards per catch and has 11 of Costello's 17 touchdowns. No other Pac-12 player has more than seven receiving touchdowns this season. I would say also to watch out for their tight end, Caden Smith, who leads Pac-12 tight ends with 494 receiving yards and had nine catches for 112 yards against Wazoo in a game where their offense played great and the Stanford defense low-key terrible.
Man,
Stanford's bad at running in defense. What year is this?
I was going to say they're the Seahawks. Both teams are the Seahawks.
They're in the bad place. Stanford ranks 50th in terms of defensive efficiency according to Football Power Index and is allowing opponents to complete a conference-high 65% of their passes for 7.6 yards per attempt. Meaning, bold prediction, Jake Browning, everyone next Sunday or Saturday night, whenever you want to say this, everyone is talking about Jake Browning's bounce-back game and how he has re-established his hold on UW's quarterback position.
That's all they're going to be talking about.
People love that storyline. And people, you know what people don't love? Adjusting for opponent quality. People hate adjusting for opponent quality. They do not recognize the Cal defense is better than Stanford.
They just
abhor it.
I love the idea of somebody hating adjusting.
I feel like that's the kind of thing.
For opponent quality, people are unable to adjust for opponent quality.
No, I think they dislike it. I can see Ben B tweeting something about opponent quality. He did tweet something about opponent quality, and people are complaining about it in his mentions.
Oh my God.
He was taking out the Seahawks schedule, and people may have had some valid points actually about the records of the teams. You made some counter arguments.
I just don't think you can't look at records alone.
No, you can't.
When we're looking at DVOA wise, it's different. That's not the case with Stanford though, because we are looking at statistically.
We sure are, and it's not the case with Cal, whose
Where
defense
were the Broncos
remains
in DVOA this week, by
really
way?
Good. The Broncos are seventh.
How are they so good in DVOA?
It's
a
long
story. They had like one blowout victory.
We don't have enough. I mean, we already played the Broncos. We didn't have enough time to get into it. But part of that,
DVOA is a little bit easy to game.
I don't know about that. Let's wrap up here on UW Stanford with chances of victory, and you can maybe expound on your feelings about this game, your vision for this game.
I'm gonna say 80% chance of victory.
So this is I like that this is, we said that you saw the upset coming against Cal and you said 80% chance of victory. It's like the tone of your 80% chance of it. I also said 80%, but the tone of it is so different.
I saw it coming, but you didn't.
You take credit for this.
I wanted to go lower, but I mean, you have the FBI win probability listed right there.
No anchoring effect right there.
It's about threat level. And in this game, I am going to walk into this game and I am not going to be scared that Stanford is going to win the entire time that I'm there.
You're going to walk into this game, sadly, without me, because I'll be at Blazers Lakers.
Because you are a fair weather Husky fan.
Went to every game I was here for during the 0-12 season. I want to know.
You missed a game. I was there. I was there in those streets.
That one Oregon
State
game.
That's where the Huskies played. The Oregon State game's always the worst game of the year.
But it was one of the games they probably had a chance of winning at that point.
And they didn't.
Yeah.
That's why it was worse.
I managed to watch that entire game at the conference I was at. I wanted to note that for the record.
You don't care about Husky football when they're not competing for a college football playoff. Admit it here.
Okay, you got me. When I had season tickets for those many years, they weren't competing for the college football playoff.
You're wearing Stanford colors right now.
Yeah, that is actually an accurate take.
Really makes you think.
It's not a Stanford shirt for the record.
It's a Nike shirt, so it's more an Oregon shirt than a Stanford shirt.
Oh, touche.
But this is a game that does not scare me. I would love for Stanford to try to force the ball down the field. It could be a game where the Husky defense really gets to make some plays.
You need to respect J.J. Arcega-Whiteside.
I fear J.J. Arcega-Whiteside, but I also know that one receiver cannot win the game against a team like this Husky defense.
I mean, that's probably true.
And the offense is good. They played a bad game against a very good Cal defense that it was...
I didn't mention. By FPI efficiency, the defense is now better than the offense. It's 23rd to 22nd. That's the massive difference.
Yeah, they're both pretty good.
Why do you need a spark for an offense that ranks 23rd in the country? Why? Why?
Neither one is amazing. They're both pretty good.
UW ranks tied for 10th in the Pac-12 in interceptions with 0.3 per game this season. That's very surprising given the secondary.
Don't worry, it'll turn around in 2 years.
Make regression to the mean work for you. I'm going to say 75% chance of victory here. I also think it's a little bit higher than FPI because...
I said 80?
Yeah. If Hunter Bryant does play, I think that gives the Huskies a weapon that they haven't had all season in the red zone, which has been a constant struggle for them, including on the crucial final drive of last Saturday's game.
I think it's play calling. I'm telling you, Bush Hammond has learned from Steve Sarkisian about play calling in the red zone.
That would be a good thing. The Falcons are good in the red zone now.
Are they good now?
Yeah, because it turns out red zone success is all completely random.
Maybe it was Bush Hammond who was holding him back last year. Wow, that's a take. Bush Hampton has been holding back Steve Sarkisian in the red zone and is holding the Huskies back.
You got to see how the sausage was made on a take there. You remembered that Bush Hampton was Atlanta last year and you connected those dots.
Yeah, absolutely I did.
Oh boy.
We're not impressed with what Bush Hampton has done.
It's not been a great season. But they are also 23rd with a bunch of injuries on offense. And the offensive line has not been nearly as good as we could have possibly expected going into the season, in large part because of Trey Adams' injury. So,
let me ask you a question right now.
Okay.
Would you trade Bush Hammond for Shoddy?
Yeah, probably.
I probably would too.
Although his collegiate offensive coordinating, not great. I still don't think that's a fair point to bring up in terms of his NFL offensive coordinating, which is looking better by the week, but not great at Georgia.
Because we now view Shoddy a little differently.
Because the Seahawks are up to 10th in offensive DVOA.
Hello!
Actually, no, I'm sorry. They're 10th in passing DVOA is what I meant there. 18th. They're still only 18th in overall
DVOA. And there's no way Russell Wilson has anything to do with that.
But they are 6th in overall DVOA. They're coming for that DVOA crown. They're not going to get it from the Rams and
Chiefs. They're not going to get it, but it's in sight. It's the first time that it's been in sight in a long time.
The non-Rams Chiefs DVOA crown is a realistic possibility, I think.
Aren't the Chiefs number one in DVOA?
They are number one in DVOA.
Number one offense those two teams, and number one special teams.
Those two teams are both over 33%. Then there's a drop-off to this week's opponent, the LA Chargers, at 20.4%.
They're like the Twix of it.
And the Seahawks are at 14.5%. So third, I think, is the highest they can reasonably aspire to get
by
the end of
the season. I really refuse to believe that the Panthers are the fourth best team in the NFL.
That's fine.
I defy
that. It's fair. Let's talk about how great Russell Wilson was on Sunday's two-touchdown win, as you called, against the Detroit Lions. It was in jeopardy for a second there. And then,
but it wasn't in jeopardy. That's the thing.
I was prepared.
By two touchdowns. The
spirit of the game would have been winning by two touchdowns. Yes. I was prepared to concede that point.
Wow, you didn't have to, because the Seahawks closed that game out.
Justin Coleman with that interception, and then Michael Dixon with the.
Are we toasting the disc?
Oh, obviously,
it was pretty fun.
The process was not great, but the results were amazing.
How does it feel to not know anything about football?
I felt better about the Seahawks' chances after the Lions, Dolphins got destroyed by the Texans on Thursday Night Football, which did seem to indicate...
So you overvalue the transitive property of football?
I do.
That's not the best process-based way to look at it.
Fine.
Some of us were looking at it statistically, as we should have.
But I think also the way this game... The game could have played out in two ways. And the first two drives seemed to confirm my fears about it, that the Lions would get ahead and... You know, the Seahawks would then be forced to take play action out of their game because how could you play action when you're behind? But lo and behold, they scored two touchdowns quickly thanks in part to a fumble on the kickoff return. And that was enough to get them in a position where they could run efficient offense the rest of the until they started running out the clock in the fourth quarter.
But the other point that we argued was that Kerryon Johnson wasn't going to be a factor.
That was correct.
And aside from one screen pass,
the two screen passes, very
one
good
was to
in
Blunt
their,
and one was to Kerryon Johnson.
The Lions running backs were very good in the pass game. They
Let's
were
just
not
hope
good
the Chargers didn't watch that film, because I think the Chargers are a pretty good screen pass team.
Oh, we've got some stats coming.
About screen passes?
Not screen passes in particular. I don't have that
well,
level of breakdown.
It's going to be horrifying.
But the Chargers have the number one running back in the league in receiving DVOA, and it's not Melvin Gordon.
Oh, is it Eckler?
Well, that's their only other running back who plays, so yes, it's Austin Eckler.
But you would not accept that Kerryon Johnson wasn't going to have a good game. And I mean, he was a non-factor in that game.
I mean, I think things might have gone differently if they had had a lead, but...
But he didn't run the ball well.
The Seahawks defense rose to the challenge, and the Seahawks defense is now up to number two in the NFL, in DVOA. And they didn't, you know, takeaways were a pretty big part of this. I mean, they had the fumble recovery on Stafford, and they did have the interception. But, like, on a play-by-play basis, they were good, too.
I mean, the takeaway that got them up by two touchdowns was huge on the kick return.
That was the one that got them the lead.
The game was over by the time the second two takeaways happened.
I don't know if it was over by the Stafford fumble.
Maybe it wasn't over, but it was close.
They were in control. I'll give you
and
that.
On that drive, I looked up their percentage chance of victory, and it was 99.7.
Okay.
That drive. So it was more or less over at that point. And the Seahawks dominated this game front to back the entire game. The last few drives were the worst drives that they have, because when offense is telegraphed, it's bad. And that's why play action works.
That's true. That checks out.
Because there isn't any sort of wearing down the defense effect of running the ball.
No, that is not a real
thing. And they weren't able to pick up first downs. I mean, there's some Lockett Bay or bad Lockett Bay that they didn't pick up a first down in one of those series or whatever.
No, they did, but first off, they did pick up a first down.
The Michael Dixon one in the last series. But I'm saying the previous couple.
All right, let's talk about Russell Wilson's game.
Oh, God.
14 of 17 for 248 yards and three touchdowns. A perfect 158.3 passer rating, although passer rating sucks. You should actually use QBR, where his 98.9 was tied with Deshaun Watson on Thursday Night Football for the best performance in the NFL this season.
Russ is back.
Yeah, not just this week, in this season.
Wow.
Russ is back. I mean, this was the highest yards per attempt in Seahawks history for...
Really?
Game. Yeah.
Oh my God.
And you also saw, the NFL Next Gen stats, based on where his passes were completed and the location of nearby defenders, said it was the best performance they had ever tracked in terms of completion performance over the expected completion percentage for an average quarterback.
Because of nearby defenders?
Mm-hmm. Because so many of these passes, which, by the way, you know, deserve some credit for that. The receivers.
Yes.
David Moore in particular.
The three touchdown catches, all of them were close. Tyler Lockett coming up with a huge catch. Ed Dixon coming up with a huge catch.
Ed Dixon. Catches, 54 yards. Only
so
one of them.
So here for the Ed Dixon comeback.
In a touchdown. Only one of those credited to Michael Dixon on the ESPN Gamecast.
And David Moore going up and getting it. I mean.
David Moore is hashtag good. Four catches, 97 yards, and a touchdown. And you know what that meant?
What?
It meant that Brandon Marshall got released.
If we called this too. In fact, I think I called this. In my God, Nostra Tristan is back this year.
You called week 8 or week 9?
I said Brandon Marshall would be released before the end of the year.
I think a lot of people called that.
Oh, come on. I was the only one.
Like, Ben B tweeted something where
the
he
Great
called
Pumpkin
it.
Is the world's first Imperial Pumpkin.
That seems like easier to prove.
Excluding nobody.
Yeah, I mean, the Seahawks pass game is good.
I mean, the thing is, the stuff that we went into the season being worried about, and I think Ben tweeted about this also, honestly, with regards to Shoddy, the things that we were worried about with him, he hasn't run with heavy sets against a stacked box all that often.
Yep.
He's run a lot. Don't get me wrong. But the team has been sort of effective running the ball.
Yep.
They've run from spread sets.
Although it is interesting, by the way, as we noted earlier, the offensive DVOA, they're 10th in passing and 17th in rushing.
17th is a lot better than last.
That is accurate. They weren't last year, but it was only because of Russell Wilson.
It's a lot better than 31st or whatever. And it's good enough at rushing to make Shoddy use the play action.
Correct.
And that's all that matters. Although, literally it.
It was interesting. Mays had a tweet, I think it was, about the record of Russell Wilson's success on play action on Sunday. And he was like really good, but he was also like equally good on non-play action passes on Sunday.
He just didn't throw that many, non-play action passes, did he?
It was about half of his attempts. He was 6 of 9 for 132 yards and a touchdown on play action, which by process of elimination means he was, I'm checking the numbers here, 8 of 8 on his other passes.
Wow.
For 116 yards and 2 touchdowns.
Russ Wilson's just good.
Yeah. I heard it was, 10th to 15th best quarterback? I heard it on a podcast. It must be true.
I mean, where does he rank? Let's look at where he ranks.
He still does not rank that high in overall QBR, as it turns out. It was surprisingly low when I went to it. Low enough that I thought that maybe it hadn't updated for this week yet. But it had, and he's still 17th in QBR, one spot behind Matthew Stafford.
Russell Wilson in the correct offense is a top 5 quarterback.
In getting time to throw, which, shout out to the offensive line.
But the other things that we were concerned with was the wide receivers. Mm-hmm. And you look at it and you're like, who's the best wide receiver on the team? Tyler Lockett looks like a very high-level wide receiver.
He's certainly been the most productive this year.
I mean, Doug Baldwin is still working his way back from victory, but looks good. David Moore. Working his way back from injury.
I want to work my way back from victory.
We're all working our way back from victory this week.
Some of us are working our way back from defeat.
Yeah, you are. In every way possible.
Not every way. I won in the Pelton Cast League. David Moore has a 76.3% DVOA this year. That's number one among receivers who have at least 6 targets.
In the NFL.
In the NFL, yeah. Oh, yeah. By a wide margin. The next best is some player named M. Johnson. Is that the M. Johnson that was the Seahawks got? In the Michael Bennett trade and released in training camp? I think it is. I'm pretty sure he went to Indianapolis. What is it, Marcus Johnson?
I don't know. I think that seems right.
Yeah, it's Marcus Johnson. He's only had 8 targets. He has 6 catches for 102 yards and a touchdown.
Still.
That's a pretty small sample size, but he is, in fact, the second most effective wide receiver on a per-play basis in the NFL after David Moore, who is catching 79% of the passes thrown his way for about 15 yards per completion per pass. So that's good. Although that is quite good. I recommend more David Moore.
David Moore's amazing. But so that was another thing we were worried about. The secondary was something that we're worried about.
True.
And where did the Seahawks rank in pass defense?
That's third.
Third
Trey Flowers,
NFL?
You know what? You were very wrong, spectacularly wrong about the idea that Shaquem Griffin should play this year. Yeah, no, I'm spectacularly wrong. Okay. They won't even let him play at all on defense.
I'm a little... And on defense? He's playing on special
teams. Yeah, he's a very valuable special teams contributor. That was granted all along. But Trey Flowers has been a really quick study. One thing I didn't realize, so I've been looking all along, Football Outsiders splits DVOA by side of the field in terms of passing on defense. And I was assuming that the side where the Seahawks were like ranked at the top of the league was the Shaquille Griffin side. It's not. It's the Trey Flowers side.
Trey Flowers is my 4th child.
Is your 9th to 16th child? The Seahawks are number 3 against passes to the right, number 26 against passes to the left.
I was telling Mrs. Fantasy Genius, I was asking her which quarterback I should start a couple weeks ago. And I was like, you know, I could start Pat Mahomes. I love him like a child. That's the way I feel about Trey Flowers. I'm not willing to go so far as to get a Trey Flowers jersey just yet because I want to give it a second. But which I need a Sherman one, by the way, to bridge the gap. If we're looking at the jerseys that I have in Seahawks history, Sean Springs, Marcus Trufant, no Sherman, which I need to figure out.
Rectify. You need to rectify that.
Trey Flowers.
Wow. Oh, boy. Massive disrespect to Shaquille Griffin, whether it's deserved statistically or not.
I love Shaquille Griffin also.
The last bit of general Seahawks news before we get to previewing this weekend's matchup, this weekend's showdown with the LA Chargers. Michael Kendricks officially has been suspended for 8 games by the NFL. He's already served 3 of those games. It's interesting because I'm not sure what Michael Kendricks' role is when he comes back now that KJ Wright is healthy.
Having depth at linebacker?
I mean, yeah, it's not a bad thing.
It's
a
very important role to have.
But I don't think he'd see the field a lot, is what I'm saying, even when he does come back. That's my expectation.
I could see there being a rotation.
Perhaps.
And honestly, like...
KJ Wright played, like, I want to say it was over 90% of snaps last week in his first game back from injury.
Injuries happen in the NFL.
True. I mean, I'm not saying that they should release him. I'm just saying I don't know that it's going to make a big difference in the season. Let's talk about the Chargers.
How do you get to 8 games for insider trading?
How do you get to any of this suspension lights? You may as well be throwing dice, casting lots. Let's talk about the LA Chargers, who come in this week's matchup against the Seahawks, having beaten everyone they have played, who is not the top two teams in the NFL. Their two losses so far coming against the Rams and the Chiefs, both of whom the Seahawks will be playing at some point this season, but yet have not yet played the Chiefs, of course.
I was going to say, they've played the Rams.
Yeah, but they still have matchups left against both those teams. At the same time, the Chargers' wins have not come against particularly good teams. Their wins so far at Buffalo, San Francisco, Oakland, at Cleveland, Tennessee. So not a murderer's row of opponents.
They've beaten by DVOA. Would you say Buffalo, who's the worst team in the league?
San Francisco,
ranked number 30th in the league.
Oakland,
ranked number 28 in the league.
Cleveland,
ranked number 27 in the league.
Tennessee,
ranked number 25 in the league.
So their best win is over number 25.
So they've beaten.
The Seahawks' best win is Dallas. Where does Dallas rank?
Dallas ranks.
Those are all bottom 18.
Number 19. They've beaten 5 of the bottom 8 teams in the league. And granted, DVOA is adjusted for strength of opponent.
Yes. They're a good team.
They have.
But this is an interesting matchup because they haven't played anyone kind of who's not amazing or terrible. Yeah. This will be their first matchup against anyone who's not amazing
and
or terrible.
Like, I watched that game in London against Tennessee. I woke up.
you earlier than I did.
I was up at 6:30 this last week. I had to make sure that T.J. Yeldon was in that lineup.
And was not in jail.
Yeah, I woke up. Got to check.
I was very glad that I did not have any Jaguars because I was not about to check after we recorded that podcast on Saturday night.
You're not competing. It's fine.
I am competing to be well-rested.
There's a reason that I beat you in fantasy this last week.
Okay, that is not why you beat me in fantasy.
Some of us, I took T.J. Yeldon out.
Signed Patrick Mahomes as a free agent. That's why you beat me.
First of all, how dare you?
I mean, that wasn't the only difference between us. You staring me down does not make for a great podcast. Does not make for great audio. Okay, so the Chargers and the Seahawks, this will be a particularly interesting matchup because these teams are mirror images of each other. The Seahawks, as we mentioned, are second in defensive DVOA and 18th in offensive DVOA. The Chargers are 18th in defense and 3rd in offense. And both of these teams excel in terms of their pass offense / pass defense and are good but not necessarily elite in terms of their rush offense / rush defense. They're a little bit more different in terms of the Seahawks offense against the Chargers defense, but also both of them better in terms of passing than rushing. So it's going to be a fascinating matchup from that standpoint. And the strength versus strength, the marquee matchup, the Chargers' number 2 ranked passing attack versus the Seahawks' number 3 ranked pass defense. Phillip Rivers, at age 36, he'll turn 37 in December, which will soon be next month, but is not yet. Number 3 in both DVOA and QBR. He's completing 69% of his passes, which is the second highest mark of his career for a career best 9.1 yards per attempt. The Chargers have gotten huge plays downfield from both Mike and Tyrell Williams, who are averaging 18.1 and 21.4 yards per respectively. They are both in the top 7 in yards per reception among qualifying players, and you do not want to see them running past Tedrick Thompson at any point this week. God,
that's scary.
Yes. Keenan Allen, of course, is their underneath receiver. His targets are down from 10 per game last season to 8 so far this year, much to dismay of my Peltoncast Fantasy League team. And the Chargers are not getting much production from Antonio Gates with Hunter Henry, their presumed starting tight end, out for the season with a torn ACL. As I mentioned, look out for Eichler on third down. He leads all running backs in receiving DVOA. Melvin Gordon, their starting running back, also a threat out of the backfield. He is averaging 5.1 yards per carry, but is just 13th in Football Outsiders success rate. Hasn't been quite as consistent play-to-play as you'd expect based on that yards average. Gordon missed the London game before their bye week with a hamstring injury. It looks like he'll probably be back for this matchup. So any thoughts on the Chargers offense versus the Seahawks defense?
It's scary.
Yeah, they're really good.
Whenever I think about the Chargers, they are the type of team that is very frustrating for the Seahawks. They're a little bit more downfield this year than they've been in the past, which, granted, the last couple of years, I think the Seahawks have given up some big plays.
Well, you're thinking of specifically that last matchup with Phil Rivers in 2014 against the defending Super Bowl champions, where he just, like, picked apart the Seahawks on third down with, like, intermediate passes all day.
When that's what this defense gives up. The one in San Diego, week two, it was a frustrating game to watch, and that is the lasting mark that kind of the Chargers...
I'm pretty sure that Keenan Allen had 20 catches in that game. I don't want to see the box score. I'm just going with that.
You think it was Keenan Allen? It was everybody.
Antonio Gates had a lot of catches.
I was going to say, there was a Gates touchdown and a crucial Antonio Gates catch.
I'm sure
there was. Which, them not having good tight ends, which, granted, still...
still Antonio Gates, still but Antonio he's Gates. Very old now. He was not on the roster before that Henry injury.
He wasn't. They brought him back.
They did. It actually turns out the leading receiver for them in that game, Gates had 7 for 96, but their leading receiver was Eddie Royal with 7 catches for 69 yards. Keenan Allen only had 5 catches for 55 yards.
I was right again. All those probably, I don't remember Keenan Allen being a factor at all.
All of those probably came on third down.
You were wrong about another thing on the You're Wrong cast. catches off.
Really something.
But this is a terrifying offense for the Seahawks. Granted, this is a different Seahawks defense than maybe even that one was kind of early in that season.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting. I think that Allen matched up versus the Seahawks cornerbacks one-on-one is going to be a really fun matchup to watch. Like, he's got such good footwork, much like Doug Baldwin, but maybe even better in that regard.
They're going to get first downs. The Chargers are going to move the ball. I was thinking of this in the Lions game where it's like, you saw field position, average starting field position for the Lions in that game was not good. And it's part of one of the factors of having Michael Dixon around and him being such an excellent punter. And then also being able to pick up first downs.
Yeah.
Where it's like, even if you don't score, picking up first downs is huge. Not having turnovers is going to
be I recommend game. Picking up first downs.
And if it's the full field and you have to give them, this is the thing that the Huskies did against Cal when the Husky defense did not give up a single touchdown. Only Jake Haener gave up a touchdown, if you remember this. But...
That's me hitting my head into the microphone.
Just if a team, let's say that the Chargers pick up 3 first downs on every series. In general, that would probably be successful.
Yeah.
But if you could have them starting at the 20 to 15 yard line and they pick up 3 first downs, that could be midfield and they're punting all of a sudden. So you get a lot of cracks at third down. And just don't give up the big plays. You know that you're going to give up third downs at some point.
Yes.
But it's just like, look for penalties, try to get sacks. Where do they rank in sack rate?
They have a top 10 offensive line in terms of both adjusted sack rate and their running.
Man, who is their left tackle?
Is he actually good there? We can't complain about that anymore.
I mean, we could have been good there for all of the intermediate years.
And maybe not giving up both the second and third round pick to be good there. But that's neither here nor there.
But it's just like, I think field position, I sound like Pete Carroll. Field position is going to matter in this game for the Seahawks defense. And if the Chargers end this offense that's going to be able to move the ball, if they can wait around, hold them to field goals, hold them to eventually punting at midfield.
Which, by the way, their punting is terrible. Last in the league in net points on punt. And they waived Drew Kayser midway through the season and replaced him with veteran Donnie Jones. It's actually worse than their place kicking, which ranks 28th in the league, and we know how bad that is.
I think that this defense can slow the Chargers down.
I hope that's the case.
By being put in the right situation. Let me just say, after that game last week, I don't see stuff getting over the top.
No, Tedrick Thompson has been told repeatedly deeper than the deepest.
And Tedrick Thompson in general, I think, has played pretty well.
I mean, you look at the numbers of the pass defense. He deserves some credit for it. I mean,
and Bradley McDougal, there was the thing.
Oh, Bradley McDougal is right. There, like, no one's questioning that.
Quick reads where he's talking about how, like, Marvin Jones drew a 56-yard penalty. And I was like, that was a bullshit 56-yard penalty. You shouldn't even count it. Everybody knows.
Drew is generous. He's generous.
Even Marvin Jones knew.
Not quite as much as who is that? Oh, Gary Harris was like gave a wry smile to the camera last week after he drew a foul against, I think it was the Warriors.
But combining that plus a turnover or two, if they're able to force them, could be a recipe for success for the Seahawks defense against the Chargers.
And the good news is that the offense should have success against this Chargers defense, which comes in 28th in adjusted sack rate this season without Joey Bosa, who has yet to play due to a foot injury. And his media availability earlier this week didn't sound like he's going to be back this week. So he said he was still, quote, week to week in terms of his return. The Chargers are number one in DVOA allowed against short passes, but 31st in DVOA against long passes. So this is an opportunity for the Seahawks to take some shots deep. They gave up touchdowns of 82, 58, and 53 yards this season, although all of those came in September.
One of those had to be Tyreek Hill.
Yes, yes. Two of those were in the Chiefs game. The other was to George Kittle at a 58-yard touchdown against them.
Oh man,
I've been in both of my fantasy leagues. The Chargers, despite that George Kittle touchdown, are number one in DVOA against opponent tight ends, but they have struggled against slot wide receivers, ranking 27th in that category. So possibly an opportunity here for the Seahawks to get Doug Baldwin in the slot and get him going in this game, much like they did in London. The Chargers have also allowed 4.6 yards per carry this season to opposing running backs, and if the Seahawks can run for 4.5 plus, I feel pretty good about how the offense is going to do.
They have a recipe for success now. 4.5 yards per carry plus the play action game. It's going to be a good offense at that point.
I mean, I think they need to be a little bit more aggressive this week because, you know, the defense is probably not going to allow 14 points this week. The Chargers are going to score points.
I'm just telling you, that's not going to happen. They're not going to be more aggressive. There is no other mode. I mean, Pete Carroll even said, he's like, we're boring. You know what we're going to do. The thing is, they don't. When he says that, he's actually wrong. Like, there are a lot of times that Pete Carroll is right, but they don't know what you're going to do because teams expect the Seahawks to run so much. Play action would be effective anytime, but the defense doesn't know what they're going to do because play action is effective.
Yes.
I almost went into it. I had to stop myself. I almost said that running helps out play action.
Oh.
Had to rein it back.
Yeah, you better. Ben V's going to come for us. We're not immune. Okay, I think that's all we have in terms of the matchup chances of victory in this one.
Seahawks minus 2.5. Yeah. I think there's a 65% chance of victory in this game.
You are more optimistic than I am. I'm going with 55% chance of victory.
55%?
If the Seahawks win this game, I mean, not to put too much on the outcome of the game, like at that point, I think it's clear they're a good team. By the way, they're down to 1.5-point favorites at this point. That was not updated. This is a really good team. And, well, home field will matter, and it's nice to actually play a home game for the first time in, like, a month, I think. Also, the first home game after the passing of Paul Allen, which is going to be very emotional for this one. I've seen two tributes to him at both the Sounders game last Sunday and the Blazers game. I'll be missing out on the Seahawks one. But I think the crowd is going to be fired up after the way the Seahawks have played the last 2 weeks.
I'm fired up. This is the most that I've cared about going to a Seahawks game. I mean, last year was fun at various times, but it's almost like it's like watching something so frustrating.
It was like the Sasuke season this year.
But now, do you feel like there's a little bit of... Was the year 2014 where they were the best offense in like NFL history? Was that 13 or 14?
I don't think it was either of them. I mean, you're thinking of the second half of 15.
That was 15.
Where the offense really got rolling.
13, they won the Super Bowl.
12 was their best offensive year before that, I'm pretty sure.
12 was the year they were good, but nobody recognized, and they lost to the Falcons.
Yes.
13 is the year they won the Super Bowl. 14 was the year that they canceled the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
15 was when they had the best team.
Just the last 30 seconds of it. Weird decision.
15, Jermaine Kearse made that catch, and then they just ended the game. What a catch. Got to go out on top. 15 was the year that they were the best offensive team in the NFL.
Yes.
Am I going too far by saying I'm feeling shades of that right now?
Like I said, I'm not ready to go there now. There's still what did we determine? 18th in overall DVOA?
Offensively?
Yeah.
Okay, they're not... But just the way that they're playing these games, beating teams badly. Like, they did not do that all season last year.
You're right. I don't dispute it.
So going into Detroit...
They were number one in both 2015 and 2014, as it turns out.
Offensively?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were really good. I miss those days. But I hear what you're saying.
Just the way that they're beating teams and the confidence that they're going into these games with.
They were 1-12 too.
It feels different, right?
Oh, I'm looking at overall, aren't I? They were fourth in 2012.
You know that we were number 1-12, 13, 14, and 15 in DVOA.
I do know that. I thought I was looking at, I thought I was looking at offensive DVOA is what I'm saying here.
I'm just saying
They were fifth in 2014.
The way that the games feel going into the games, the Seahawks have a little bit of swag back.
Yeah.
It feels for the first time in 2+ years like this is the Seahawks again.
It's fun.
It's fun.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And I love it. And I'm excited to go to the Seahawks game.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the whole thing could go up in flames this weekend.
I mean, unless they get blown out. Like, look, the Chargers are a really good team. Losing to them, there's no shame in losing to the Chargers, even if it's at home.
Winning this game, though.
65% of the time.
There's
65% of the time, it works every time.
There's a difference between cognitively understanding that it's a 65% chance of victory and feeling like the Seahawks are going to win. Does that make sense?
There's definitely a cognitive difference, that's for sure.
I feel good about this game. I'm excited for it.
Okay. Yeah, you should be.
I think that the offense is going to move, and I think the defense is going to do just enough, and I think the Seahawks are going to win this game by more than one score.
Okay.
They're going to win this by one touchdown.
31-24?
I was thinking, I was listening to the pregame show because I'm a masochist. I was listening to the pregame show on the radio after getting breakfast, and they were doing all the scores, and they were like 28-24, 28-27. And I was like, 28-13 is my score.
Oh.
Final score, 28-14. You like that?
Nostra Tristan.
You like that? Anyway, one touchdown.
Your Nostra Tristan hat right now is a Lil Woody's burger hat.
Hey, everybody knows about the burger's hat. The burger head?
They do.
Whew, I'm fired up for some football this weekend.
Well, on that note,
I can't wait to get wet. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.